think it's really important that we kind of wake up to the reality that church history didn't start 5 years ago.
But the true meaning of Scripture is reserved for holy readers, for the church. If you were to ask Irenaeus what the difference between exegesis and theology is, he wouldn't know what to say.
Why that needs to change is that makes Satan an equal with God. Welcome back. Third and final episode of our kind of broad overview of church history. You've told us that that's the American Sign Language action for church history.
Reading Rainbow is what I think of when I think of that.
Butterfly in the Sky.
What's his name?
LeVar Burton.
LeVar Burton, yeah.
Geordi
yeah.
LaForge.
Yeah.
If you like Star Trek.
Yeah. That's a copyright claim. You can't do that.
We can refer to the existence of the show.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure
that's
we
safe.
Can do that, yeah. Period one of church history covered was the pastors as public theologians doing theology for the salvation of souls in the community. Last episode, period two, was the monks as public theologians. Augustine is the starting point for the monks. He doesn't have a category. We covered that. This is the most interesting to me because it's broad, but it sets a couple balls in motion that hadn't been there. And this is your academics in as public theologians category.
Yeah. The year I gave is about 1,000 when the universities came on the scene in across Europe. And my students always are desperate for an end date because I have, 0 to 500, 500 to 1,000, 1,000 dash.
Second coming.
What's the end date? Yeah. No, we're still in this era, I think. It's the theologian or the academics who are leading the theology. You look at any book. We went to ETS a few weeks ago. The book room, all these guys writing the books are professional academics.
With their credentials listed in their major fields of study. It's a normal thing.
Yeah.
And so Augustine was our hinge character between the first two periods of church history. I am going to posit to you that the hinge character between the monks and the academics is Anselm of Canterbury.
Okay.
What do you think about that?
It fits chronologically right about that time. Yeah. Why do you think he is a good hinge figure?
Well, Anselm is one of the first distinct public philosophers in that period of church history. I mean, you've got guys like the apologists in the early church are doing some distinct work on philosophy. Justin Martyr is doing some of that.
Augustine.
Augustine does some of that. But Anselm is the guy who takes up the arguments for the existence of God. He's working on that level. At the same time, he's codifying parts of atonement theory. And so he has his feet in a lot of sections of the game board, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of works.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, this shift of, a lot of different things shift. Not just who is doing the theology and who's asking the questions, but exegesis is shifting too. The way you approach scripture,
And who's asking the questions automatically gets paired with who are the answers for? Who do they help and how do they help?
Yeah.
So Anselm, my guy, because I'm a great lover of the ontological argument for the existence of God. Not because I think it's perfect, but I think it's very helpful for beginning level apologetics and how do I even talk about the necessity of God's existence?
Do you want to give a 20-second definition of the ontological?
So,
summarize his life work in 20 seconds.
And well, it's really only 4 points, so I should be able to do it. So step one is that God is a being of the most perfect being. I can't remember the way he phrases it, but God is the most perfect being that exists. Step two is a being in reality is more perfect than a being in thought only.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Step three is I can conceive of God's existence. And step four, therefore, God must be real.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's the argument. It doesn't actually prove God's existence, which is why people get so annoyed with it. Is like, well, it doesn't work to prove God's existence. It doesn't need.
Yeah.
To work. What it works on is what we would, and this is an academic category, is the necessity of God, is one of God's attributes, is that it's just, he is eternally necessary for the existence of all other things. C.S. Lewis has some things on that, and other philosophers do.
Mm-hmm.
But you got Anselm right about the year 1000 is doing this work when atheism isn't even really
a category
yet. Mm. You know, that, you know, the Enlightenment gets a Descartes, probably gets us most of the way there with those arguments. But but Anselm starts arguing, is like, okay, how do we know that God exists? And because a real person is better than an idea, and we all conceive of God's existence. It's an incredibly useful, simple argument for the existence of God.
And there's a reason it's lasted for 1,000 years and been attacked and modified and represented for over 1,000 years.
Yeah, if it wasn't that effective, we probably wouldn't be talking about it, or wouldn't even know about it. It was a bad idea.
Yeah.
And then, doctrinally speaking, on the flip side, Anselm is a major shift in soteriology that Anselm spearheads. And almost all of the theologians prior to the year 1000 talk about atonement as ransom, as a payment to free sinners. And
Western side of the church,
Western
at least.
Side, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're Western, so yeah. But thank you for that clarification. So you have this ransom theory of atonement that says Jesus pays the price. And that kind of, and this is where I'm a little bit fuzzy, it ends up being in the later periods of the first millennium of church history, Jesus pays the price to Satan for the souls. Mm-hmm. And the why that needs to change is that makes Satan an equal with God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you go down a dark path. That's where you go, you know, go down. And
yeah.
Anselm goes to the substitutionary theory of atonement, that Jesus is our substitute.
The payment, the satisfaction is given to God to whom it is owed.
Yeah. And as long as the ransom is that we are ransoming from God's just and righteous penalty, totally fine. We speak in terms of that, and we want to speak in terms of that. But we can't let Satan creep onto the scene, and, you know, he doesn't get primacy of place right next to God.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how it works. And so the satisfaction and the substitution, this is where we start seeing that emphasis creep into church history.
Helpful. Yeah.
Very helpful.
And you're right, not just who's asking the questions, but who is it for? And it's academics talking to academics, trying to solve these questions. And there's nothing wrong with precision, like you said, nothing wrong with trying to answer and organize doctrines in particular ways to answer these questions. But when you fall in the ditch on either side, that's where you run into trouble.
And right answers for the sake of right answers are good.
Yeah.
Precision for the sake of communication is good. And this is where I'm going to introduce Thomas Aquinas.
our good friend.
our good friend Thomas Aquinas, who probably in Lutheran circles gets more of a bad rap than he deserves, but at least some of his bad rap is deserved.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I think so, yeah. He exemplifies this scholastic era of church history, the academic side of church history. A seminary class I teach, I taught, we went through a sermon that Thomas Aquinas preached on a parable, and it's the most dry scholastic sermon I've ever read. Just, it reads like a treatise, right? Just a point explanation, some scripture references. It's scholasticism, and he is a key figure in it for sure.
Yeah, Thomas was made fun of as a younger man because they thought he was slow. You know, they thought he was kind of dumb.
Hmm.
And it turns out he was just so thorough.
Yeah.
That he had to understand everything. And he's so thorough and methodical, and certainly comes out in his theology, in the Summa, and things like that. But Thomas sets the stage for the Reformation. Thomas brings back Aristotelian philosophy into the church. And in fact, one of the main reasons why Lutherans believe what they believe about Holy Communion is because Thomas codifies transubstantiation with Aristotelian principles.
Mm-hmm.
And Luther's like, nope, we're not going to go there. We can't go there. Before we get to Luther, who, by the way, is an academic theologian,
he's
a professor in a university.
Also monastic tendencies too,
yeah,
right?
And a pastor.
Yeah.
Let's bridge the gap between Thomas and Luther, because that's a couple hundred years of time. Anyone we should be aware of?
Aquinas to Luther. Well, you got guys like Gabriel Biel, who I think Luther probably responded to more than Aquinas. The reception of Aquinas into Biel is probably what Luther was interacting with a lot more, just nominalism and these scholastic teachings is what shapes Luther.
Yeah, you've got if Luther's critiquing Biel, Luther's building an active theology off a guy like Nicholas of Lyra,
who
influences Luther quite a bit. Not really known today for his writings, more known just in his association with Luther.
Yeah, the common, what, is it a ditty? I should have written this down. If Lyra hadn't sung, Luther wouldn't have danced, or something like that.
Yeah, something to that effect. Yeah. And then you've got the proto-reformers.
Yeah.
In this, so Jan Hus.
Sure.
Tyndale.
Yeah, Savonarola.
He's a great guy.
My good friend Savonarola.
Who has a hymn in the Ambassador Hymnal.
I didn't know that.
You didn't know that?
Yeah,
Savonarola. I can't remember. It's in the 400s.
Okay.
You can look it up in the author index. He's got a hymn in a proto-Roman Catholic reformer.
Sure, yeah.
And
sorry, even guys like Erasmus could be a pre-Luther, contemporary with Luther. Reformer. Erasmus didn't leave the church. He kind of tried to reform, humanistic reform from within the church. But Luther wasn't, this critique of the Roman Catholic Church wasn't anything new for Luther.
No, but reformers, like reform movements, you can, some of the earliest reform movements are right around the time of Anselm, really. It's,
sure.
You get into that, it's not necessarily successful or with a lot of momentum, but
yeah.
The need for correction starts to become more and more obvious. I think one of the most misunderstood things about Luther in how he did things is Luther did not want to start a new church.
Yeah.
Luther always considered what he taught to be consistent with the flow of church history. And, you know, if you would press him, he would say, no, the Roman Catholic Church of my day, they're the breakoff sect.
Sure. The Augsburg Confession at its heart is a unity document, right?
Yep.
Trying to find agreement between these two trajectories.
And to explain, this is why we are making this stand. It's the Augsburg Confession is best seen as, okay, you guys are a new group. The Roman Catholics are recognized. Tell us why you are the way you are. What is it you believe so we can get our brains wrapped around this? The Roman Catholic response ended up not being that charitable as the Diet of Augsburg was, you know, kind of framed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we have. And so Luther is reforming as an academic, but trying to really recover the pastoral nature of Scripture for individual believers. So he's synthesizing the prior two eras of church history.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably a correlation between this shift to the academics doing theology and all these reform movements. Further and further away from these first two eras of church history, this is when the reform movement, there's other things happening too that cause this, but the reform movements happen in this academic third of church history.
Well, and Luther explains it like in the prefaces to the Small and Large Catechism. The catechisms were written after his Saxon visitation, where he spends, you know, several weeks in the countryside visiting the parish churches.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, wait, the pastors don't even know Scripture. The pastors can't even recite the Ten Commandments or the Lord's Prayer. We've got to do something about this. The more and more the academics carry the debates of the day away from practical application, the less in touch people are with Scripture, with the personal expressions of their faith, with their own salvation, and that's where Luther's heart is at.
Yeah. Having this framework in view, these three-thirds, really highlights the exceptions and the people who reach back to these other priorities and emphases like Luther does. I think tying all three of these priorities together in one Lutheran movement.
Yeah, well, we can pat ourselves on the back for that,
right? Good work. Good work, us.
You're welcome. Yeah, good job. Calvin, same. I mean, so it's like in this, you brought up Erasmus.
Yeah.
And then you've got Luther, and then you've got Calvin. And so Erasmus is a humanist reformer. He is trying to recover the trajectory of the church, what, for the sake of the goodness of humanity, and like we're just all trying to be the best people we can be.
Yeah. Add Fontes to the sources, yep. The cry of the humanists.
Yeah. Well, and Erasmus has a deep respect for scripture.
Yeah. Yep.
Luther has a deep respect for insulting Erasmus, bondage of the will. Yeah.
Calvin really, yeah, different from, Calvin is different from Luther. I don't know if that's a groundbreaking
insight. He's an academic.
Insight.
Yeah.
He's an academic, yeah. He doesn't have that, it's probably not charitable to say, not the pastoral heart and the monastic emphasis that Luther had, more of an academic.
It sounds uncharitable, but I don't think that's, you know, your typical Lutheran insult of what we disagree with about Calvin or Calvinism. Calvin isn't really known as a pastor.
Yeah.
He's a systematician. He's a city administrator. Right. It's not his lane.
Yeah.
And I don't know that, you know, other than critiquing that or identifying that as a reality, that's actually, you know, meant to be derogatory.
It is accurate, I suppose.
It is what it is,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
But it does explain maybe a little bit of the Lutheran response to Calvinist theology.
Yeah. Yeah, I love seeing Luther as the one who ties all three of these emphases together.
I think it's worthwhile to view the Reformation in light of that. And, you know, Calvinist had his systemizing, and then Calvin's student Beza takes that to the nth degree. But the Lutherans after Luther, and really maybe we would say starting with Chemnitz, who was the second generation of Lutheran,
yep.
Responsible for, you know, co-writing the Formula of Concord, the last document in the Book of Concord, Chemnitz launches kind of our own Lutheran scholastic movement in the 17th century.
Yeah.
So let's kind of sum this up. We're going to tie it together, and then we're going to refer to some helpful books that you've got.
Sure.
Where have we come from? Why is, you know, the last three episodes we've talked about, why does that matter for anyone right now who, you know, might not? I don't think the church on a congregational level necessarily does a good job of talking about church history. So make your, you know, elevator pitch for we need to be better.
Yeah, history is important. We need to know our history. I think I mentioned it before, but the easy reason is history is cyclical. It repeats itself. The same errors that these early heretics made are oftentimes made today. I think if we thought about a major heretical tendency today,
Mormonism. Let's talk about that because that fits right into the early church.
Sure, it would be. I was going to say it would be Trinitarian.
Yep.
And Mormonism is. Yeah, these Trinitarian errors were made and addressed in the early church, and we are still making, or the world is still making, Trinitarian errors. We can learn how to respond to them,
and why to respond to them.
Yeah, salvation. Our salvation is the heart of all these issues. If you misunderstand salvation, if you misunderstand the Trinity, you misunderstand Christology, your salvation is going to be threatened.
And to throw a bone to the academics, this is where precision matters, because it's so much of the flux in theology today is because people are co-opting the same terms and giving them different definitions.
Sure. I think you can be precise and not be in this
dry.
Yeah. Well, you look at the, Council of Chalcedon and the fifth and the sixth ecumenical councils as well. They're very precise in their Christological terminology and how the two natures related to each other. Very precise. Words mattered a great deal, but it was for the people. It's for the sake of souls.
Also, the Athanasian Creed, incredibly precise,
yeah.
Where we need to be on the Trinity. I do one of these exercises occasionally in class where I just pick a random student and say, I'll start talking about the Trinity. Tell me everything you know of the Trinity, and I'll stop you.
Yeah.
And I generally stop them when they start, you know, going down the road of heresy, because,
sure.
You know, it's like, well, the Trinity's like an egg or yeah. Like an apple or like a three-leaf, and you don't want to do that. And so that's why we have the Creed. Is the best things we can say about the Trinity are right here.
Yeah. Yep. So important. When we confess the Nicene or Apostles' Creed in church every week, we're joining ourselves with this early church. We're saying that we believe the same things that they believed and are responding to the same errors that they're responding to for the sake of, for us men and for our salvation.
I think it's really important that we kind of wake up to the reality that church history didn't start 5 years ago.
Yeah.
That there's a thread running through the millennia that end up being really important for who we are right now.
Yeah.
So walk us through the books on the table. Let us know how they're useful, why you might recommend them.
Start with the bottom one. I teach a class in the college, Foundations of Christian History. We follow this book, Mark Knoll, Turning Points. He picks 13 events in church history that were significant turning points, hence the name of the title, Turning Points.
Clever.
Things like Council of Nicaea, the coronation of Charlemagne.
Christmas Day.
Yeah, 800, yeah.
1225, 800.
Conversion of the Wesleys. Like the whole scope of church history. It's not comprehensive. It's selective. It's a survey course. I think he does a really good job on picking these 13 events that happened, and we just take a one a week and talk about them. So I think it's a helpful class. Yeah. Also in the college, I do an elective. Fathers of the Church is what it's called, the Church Fathers. So we talk through several of the these people we've talked about. This Brian Litvin wrote this book. Helpful book. It's not as sacramental as I would like it to be. There's so much, a rich history of the sacraments in early church history, teachings on their being effective, on the real presence, all these things that an evangelical author isn't going to necessarily highlight. But this is still a helpful book to just get to know these early church figures in the earliest centuries. Again, this is all from the first third of our church history. In the seminary, this is one of the books I assign. Stephen Pressley, Biblical Theology and the Life of the Early Church, really talking through what I mentioned about the exegetical trajectory. How did exegesis, or how did you read the Bible in the early church? How was Scripture read? And the principles that they use are oftentimes different than the way we view Scripture. I think this academic third of church history has negatively affected how we approach Scripture. There's been a separation of exegesis and theology because of this academic trajectory where interpreting Scripture is seen as something anybody can do. It's a science you can do. You look at the context, you try to find out what the original author might have meant and what these words meant in the original context, and it has nothing to do with the life of the church and the theology in general. The early church, these two things were the same. If you were to ask Irenaeus what the difference between exegesis and theology is, he wouldn't know what to say.
Cock his head sideways and like, what?
Yeah, they're the same thing. It's the same conversation. Scripture is interpreted in the church for the sake of the church. The book, the Bible, is seen as a fundamentally different kind of a book than any other book. It can accomplish spiritual realities. It's a holy book, and it needs to be read by holy readers. It can't be read by unbelievers. They can maybe see the words and comprehend what the words mean, but the true meaning of Scripture is reserved for holy readers, for the church.
One I didn't think to brag until right now, but I would also recommend, and you can buy it through Ambassador Publications, is one of the textbooks we use for Intro to Christian Thought in the Bible College by Kenneth Samples. It's an Introduction to Christian Thinkers. And I believe it's 9 chapters on 9 key figures throughout church history. Starts with Irenaeus, then you got Athanasius, Augustine, and Anselm are the big early ones. Then it gets Aquinas, Luther, Calvin, Blaise Pascal, C.S. Lewis, and I'm missing... No, that's 9, so I got them all. Really, really helpful, broad biographical sketches of those Christian thinkers and an overview of the areas of influence that they had in the flow of Christian thought. So really nice book to pick up if it's something you're looking at, an introduction to the individuals in church history.
Cool, yeah.
So that's what we got. Dr. Andrew Nealon, thank you very much for joining me on this unnamed podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We just ran through 1,500 years of church history. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet.